This is Talk of the Nation. I'm Neil Conan in Washington. Last year, the London Review of Books ran a long article called The Israel Lobby and U.S. Foreign Policy. The piece argued that a loose coalition of interest groups, some Jewish, some not, exerts a stranglehold on U.S. policy in the Middle East and stifles public debate. They also argued that unconditional American support for Israel does not serve America's interests or Israel's. Authors John Mearsheimer and Stephen Walt may not have been looking for a fight, but they found one. Both are heavyweight political scientists from, respectively, the University of Chicago and Harvard, long associated with the realist school of thought, which, very broadly, argues that the U.S. should treat states as they are, not as we wish them to be. They found themselves, though, attacked by some as anti-Semites. Now, Walt and Mearsheimer have expanded their paper into a lengthy book. In a moment, John Mearsheimer joins us, and later we'll hear from a critic who believes the book is flawed, but important. Later in the hour, a new documentary film that recounts the overthrow of the Allende government in Chile and the political exile of Ariel Dorfman. But first, the Israel lobby. Why does the United States support Israel more than any other country in the world? Because it's strategically important? Because of a moral commitment? Or because of the influence of a powerful interest group? Our number, 800-989-8255. That's 800-989-TALK. Email talk@npr.org. You can also join the conversation on our blog. That's at npr.org/blogofthenation. John Mearsheimer heads the program on international security policy at the University of Chicago, and he's co-author of The Israel Lobby and U.S. Foreign Policy. He joins us today from member station KQED in San Francisco. And John Mearsheimer, nice to have you back on the program.
It's a pleasure to be here, Neil.
Strategy, morality, or influence, can it be all three?
No, not in this particular case. I think that during the Cold War, one could make a good case that Israel was a strategic asset to the United States because Israel did defeat a number of Soviet client states, and in fact, it helped drive Egypt out of the Soviet orbit and into the American orbit. But once the Cold War ended and terrorism became a major problem for the United States, it was hard, if not impossible, to make the argument that Israel is a strategic asset.
Don't Israel and the United States have the same terrorist enemies?
No, they don't have the same terrorist enemies. And in fact, groups like Hamas and Islamic Jihad and Hezbollah are principally focused on Israel, not on the United States. This is not to say that terrorism is a good thing and that the United States shouldn't do what it can to eliminate that terrorist problem with those groups, but those groups are not putting their crosshairs on the United States. But the more important point, Neil, is that we, the United States, have a terrorism problem in good part, not only because of, but in good part because of our support for Israel's policies in the occupied territories, specifically Israel's brutal treatment of the Palestinians.
And then there is the morality issue that the United States and Israel are sympathetic to each other in all kinds of profound ways. A democracy in the Middle East, the United States instrumental in the founding of Israel.
Yeah. Let me be very clear. We believe that there is a powerful moral case for Israel's existence. And we make it clear in the article, we made it clear in the book, and we have made this clear in numerous public appearances that we believe that the existence of Israel is in America's interest from a moral perspective, and should its existence or its survival be threatened, the United States should come to its defense. The issue here, however, is a different one. The question is whether or not the unconditional aid that Israel gets, the magnificent support and the unconditional nature of that support can be explained by moral considerations. And our argument is that if you look at how the Israelis have behaved towards the Palestinians in the occupied territory since 1967, it's impossible to make the argument that that unconditional aid can be explained by moral considerations. Yes, there's no question that the fact that Israel is a democracy and that America is a democracy does drive the two countries together. But if you look around the world, you'll see that there are lots of democracies. India's a democracy, Britain's a democracy, Germany's a democracy. But none of these countries get the unconditional aid that Israel gets.
And what you mean by unconditional is that no matter what Israel does, even when it is openly in defiance of U.S. wishes, it does not get punished for it.
Exactly. And a perfect example of this would be the settlements. It has been official American policy of every American president since 1967 to oppose the settlements in the West Bank and in the Gaza Strip. Yet no American president has been able to put any meaningful pressure on Israel to stop settlement building. And the principal reason for this is the power of the lobby. Now, what's amazing about this situation is that it's not only not good for the United States, because as I said before, it fuels our terrorism problem, it's not good for Israel either. Many Israelis and many American Jews and many non-Jewish supporters of Israel in the United States now recognize that it would have been much better if America had gone to great lengths to use its leverage to prevent the Israelis from trying to colonize the occupied territories, because it's turned out to be both a moral and strategic blunder of the first order from Israel's perspective and, of course, from America's perspective as well.
You write in the book, the Israel lobby is not a conspiracy or a cabal of any sort. It is thoroughly American and legitimate, with a few exceptions. What do you mean by a few exceptions?
Well, just on why it's thoroughly American.
Okay.
It's very important to understand that the American political system at its heart is based on interest group politics. And interest groups basically means lobbies. And we have had, since the country was founded, all sorts of interest groups that have punched well above their weight, because interest groups matter greatly in the United States. And the Israel lobby, we argue, is akin to the National Rifle Association, to the American Association of Retired People, to the farm lobby, to the Cuban lobby. There are all sorts of lobbies out there that try and push American foreign policy or American domestic policy in particular ways. So what the Israel lobby is doing is in no way conspiratorial or evidence of a cabal. It's just good old-fashioned American politics. Now, the one exception to that is that certain groups in the lobby have, over time, tried to marginalize critics and silence critics by smearing them. Just take Jimmy Carter. Last year, President Carter wrote a book that, in effect, accused the Israelis of pursuing apartheid policies in the occupied territories. He was called a Jew hater. He was called an anti-Semite. He was said to be sympathetic to Nazis. He was said to be sympathetic to terrorists. He was accused of plagiarism. Now, whatever one thinks of Mr. Carter as a president, he is a fundamentally decent man, and he is a philo-Semite of the first order. In fact, he has done much for Israel's security, probably more than any other president, because he was the principal person who pushed Israel and Egypt to reach a peace agreement in the late 1970s. He's not an anti-Semite, but yet because he was critical of Israeli policy in the occupied territories, he was smeared. And of course, we've run into this same problem ourselves. Mm-hmm. And the end result of it is to try and silence critics and to create a situation where it's almost impossible to criticize Israel, which we argue is not good for the United States and not good for Israel either.
We're talking with John Mearsheimer, co-author of the newly published book, The Israel Lobby and U.S. Foreign Policy. If you'd care to join us, 800-989-8255, email talk@npr.org. And let's turn to Jesse. Jesse's with us from Berkeley, California. Jesse, you there? Jesse?
Hi,
Jesse.
I wanted to comment on the accusation of anti-Semitism. I'm a Jew, and I have two problems with people accusing critics of Israel, of which I am one, of anti-Semitism. First, I think it really dilutes the problem of anti-Semitism, which is real. However, people like myself and Walt and Mearsheimer are not the real anti-Semites that need to be dealt with. Like racists of any sort. And second, I feel like it's the easy go-to answer for the defenders of Israel's human rights violations, where they don't have to address the policies, the issues, or the facts, and they merely call the critic an anti-Semite discredit them personally and refuse to have an open debate.
Mm-hmm.
So I want to thank you for having this show, which is all too rare in this country.
Well, thanks very much for the call, Jesse. Appreciate it.
Thank you.
I think, by the way, Neil, the caller hit the nail right on the head. The basic reason that the lobby or elements in the lobby call Jimmy Carter an anti-Semite, or they call us an anti-Semite, call us anti-Semites, is because they want to shift the focus from the substance of the charge to us and make us and the question of whether or not we're anti-Semites the issue that people talk about, rather than talk about whether Israel's policies in the West Bank are apartheid or not.
It should be pointed out that you do argue in the book that the Israel lobby is not just Jews.
Absolutely. If you look at poll data on the American Jewish community, what you discover is that roughly one-third of American Jews don't feel any serious attachment to Israel. And for that reason, they could hardly be considered part of the Israel lobby. So to argue that this is a Jewish lobby would be mistaken from that perspective. But furthermore, some of the key players in the lobby are not Jewish. And the most prominent example of this is a group that's widely known as the Christian Zionists. These are hard-nosed Christian evangelicals who play a key role in pushing pro-Israel policies. John Hagee's Christians United for Israel is a good example of this. It's also worth noting, Neil, that a number of the neoconservatives, a number of the prominent neoconservatives like John Bolton and James Woolsey, who are very pro-Israel and who we would categorize as being part of the Israel lobby, are not Jewish.
We're talking with John Mearsheimer about his book, The Israel Lobby and U.S. Foreign Policy. Of course, there are those who disagree, many of them strongly, with his arguments. We'll talk with one of them next, and more of your calls, 800-989-8255, 800-989-TALK. You can also send us email, talk@npr.org. I'm Neil Conan. It's the Talk of the Nation from NPR News. This is Talk of the Nation. I'm Neil Conan in Washington. Controversy erupted last year when John Mearsheimer and Stephen Walt released their paper titled The Israel Lobby and U.S. Foreign Policy. They've now expanded those arguments in a new book. The debate and the criticism have fired up again. If you're interested, you can find an excerpt from The Israel Lobby and read the paper that sparked last year's debate at our website, npr.org/talk. John Mearsheimer is with us, professor of political science and co-director of the Program on International Security Policy at the University of Chicago, co-author of the paper and of the book. We also want to hear from you. Why does the United States support Israel more than any other country in the world? Because of its strategic importance, because of a moral commitment, or because of the influence of a powerful interest group? 800-989-8255. Email is talk@npr.org, and you can read what other listeners have to say at our blog, npr.org/blog of the nation. John Mearsheimer is with us from San Francisco, and Aaron David Miller joins us now. He spent a great deal of time involved in the relationships between Israel, the Middle East, and the U.S. He advised six secretaries of state during Arab-Israeli negotiations. He's a scholar at the Woodrow Wilson Center here in Washington and author of the forthcoming book, The Much Too Promised Land, America's Elusive Search for Arab-Israeli Peace, and joins us on the phone now from Oxford, Maine. Thanks very much for taking the time to be with us today.
Pleasure, Neil.
And I know that you have some problems with this book, but I also know that you believe it to be important. Why?
Well, I think the two professors have identified a critically important issue in America's Middle East policy. I'm not sure I would describe the book as a thoroughly important one. I think the issue is so important that it's imperative to have a brutally honest discussion, but in the course of that discussion, to try to get it right. I think that the two professors attach far too much importance to the influence of the pro-Israeli community as a force in America's Middle East policy, and the pro-Israeli community attaches not enough importance to the influence of domestic politics.
U.S. domestic policy?
Neither side in this argument, it seems to me, is being rigorous or honest enough in trying to reach the appropriate conclusion.
In what way do you think the authors are being dishonest?
Well, I don't think it's possible, frankly, to evaluate this subject without thoroughly discussing it with the lobby and those who are lobbied. And that's what I've tried to do in this book that'll be out early next year.
Well, we'll be happy to talk about your book when it comes out and we've had a chance to read it. But what about Professor Mearsheimer and Walt's book?
I think, by and large, they've missed the two or three critically important points. First, the pro-Israeli community constitutes a powerful voice. There's no question. But it is not a veto. It does not have a veto. The influence in Congress clearly is great, and particularly on issues pertaining to aid. There's no question about it. But its influence is much less rigorous and consequential the farther away you move from Congress. The pro-Israeli community in this country, which is now, as you know, not just the purview of 5.3 million American Jews, but millions of evangelical Christians and Americans, is based on a very strong foundation. I forget the moral issue. I'd call it value affinity. The perception by most Americans, and the polling continues to support this, particularly in a post-9/11 world, that Israelis are more or less like Americans. And I'm not sure that the influence of the pro-Israeli community would be nearly as decisive if it weren't for this foundation. Our system, however imperfect, is really a system that's designed to be lobbied. It's a process of competition between interest groups, Congress, the power of the executive, and I think it's the interaction between those and among those groups that ultimately defines the national interest. When presidents lead, strong presidents lead and define that interest, lobbies almost always will follow, sometimes noisily, sometimes angrily. In the case of Arab-Israeli peacemaking, which is the issue I know best, lobbies don't carry the day.
Well, let's get
Nixon and Kissinger, Jimmy Carter, George H.W. Bush and James Baker, all of them pursued consequential diplomacy with the cooperation of Israel, confronted pro-Israeli elements, and because it was in the national interest, they won their respective battles.
Let's get Professor Mearsheimer a chance to respond to some of those criticisms. Professor?
Yeah, let me make two points, Neil. First of all, we did not argue that the lobby is all-powerful and it gets his way every time. Our argument is that the lobby is a very powerful interest group, and it does shape U.S. Middle East policy in powerful ways. And I think readers will just have to look at the book and decide for themselves whether they think we're fair or convincing on that point. More importantly, Mr. Miller raises this argument, which you often hear, that our policy towards Israel can be explained by the fact that Americans love Israel because we share the same values. I think there's no question, if you look at the poll data, that Americans, generally speaking, support the existence of Israel, and they believe that the United States should come to Israel's defense if its survival is threatened. There's no question about that. But if you look at the poll data, it does not support the argument that the American people back unconditional aid to Israel and a one-sided approach to the Israeli-Palestinian problem. For example, in 2005, the Anti-Defamation League, which is a key organization inside the lobby, released a poll that showed that 78% of Americans believe that the United States should favor neither side in the Arab-Israeli conflict. In 2003, the Pew Foundation released a poll that showed that 60% of Americans favor withholding aid from Israel if it resists U.S. pressure to settle the Israeli-Palestinian conflict. Now, I think what this shows is that the American people definitely are behind supporting the survival of Israel, but they believe we should have a more variegated policy, a more conditional policy. The reason that we don't have that conditional policy is because the politicians in Washington understand full well that if they challenge the unconditional relationship or they talk about the power of the lobby, they're going to be in serious trouble. And we see that happening today with Representative Jim Moran, who is in really hot water because he made a number of statements about AIPAC, one of the key organizations in the lobby, that are true, but nevertheless, you're not allowed to say in American politics because the lobby will land on you like a ton of bricks, which they've done with Congressman Moran.
Aaron David Miller, I know you want to get back in on this, but I wanted to bring some listeners into the conversation, too. So let's give Mike a chance. Mike is calling us from Denver, Colorado.
Yes, Neil, thanks for taking my call.
Just sure.
Wanted to make a couple comments. First of all, more indirectly, 9/11 and then Afghanistan and even more directly, Iraq. All of these issues we're dealing with have to do with a large degree to our support of Israel. Bin Laden's greatest recruiting tool is our treatment and our support of Israel's treatment of the Palestinians. In Iraq, you know, Saddam Hussein was a bad guy on a lot of levels, but, you know, despite what George Bush says, Saddam Hussein was never a threat to the United States, but he was a possible threat to Israel. And I think the Israeli lobby is what pushed, you know, the people who pushed for this war are the same people who pushed for unconditional support of Israel. So I think they used 9/11 to get rid of Saddam Hussein to eliminate his threat to Israel and not to a threat or perceived threat that there was to the United States, which there was not.
Aaron David Miller, let me ask you, one of the assertions in the book is that, in fact, the Israel lobby was a critical element in the buildup of the United States and the arguments to go to war in Iraq. Do you take issue with that?
I do. I think that Iraq was brought to you courtesy of a idiosyncratic set of circumstances, in part 9/11, in part an administration that believed in transformative diplomacy, the need to change regimes as if this was going to be somehow a magic guarantee of democracy, and even an end to the Arab-Israeli conflict. So I don't buy that notion. My contentions are two. Number one, we need the special relationship with Israel. It's a reflection of value affinity. And it, in some respects, is the key to our influence in this region. And I do believe that when that special relationship, so critical to our interests, becomes exclusive, when that special relationship becomes exclusive, then I think American interests suffer. But the broader point is one that addresses the subject at hand, which is how influential is the pro-Israeli community in skewing to the detriment of American national interests, American policy. And what I'm suggesting to you is when strong presidents articulate a national interest, they manage not only to trump domestic politics, but to bring credit on American diplomacy, and in the process, as most Israeli prime ministers would accede to, benefit Israeli interests as well.
Mm-hmm.
So I would not deny at all. In fact, I think I mentioned initially that I think the two professors have identified a critically important issue that needs to be discussed. But we need to find a way to put that issue in its proper perspective. And the farther away you get from Congress to where policy is actually made when it comes to diplomacy and when it comes to war and or peace, it is the executive branch's prerogatives, privileges, policies, combined with a unique set of regional opportunities that carries the day. I mentioned before that President Nixon and Kissinger, President Carter, President George H.W. Bush, and James Baker all encountered domestic political opposition in the course of three efforts to do serious diplomacy.
Mm-hmm.
And they all managed to overcome it and succeed. Conversely, George W. Bush, who in my judgment is pursuing a flawed policy with respect to Iraq, also manages to trump domestic political interests. Lobbies, and in this case, perhaps even the support of the majority of the American people, as well as the Congress. It's all about, in the end, how committed, determined, and focused the president is. We need a policy in the Middle East when it comes to Arab-Israeli peacemaking that is based on a special relationship with the Israelis, but does not become exclusive. And that is, it seems to me, the key to finding the right balance between domestic political support and interest groups and the broader interests of the United States. I no more want the two professors to define what American national interests would be than I would AIPAC the Senate Foreign Relations Committee, or my former employer, the Department of State.
Aaron David Miller, thank you very much for joining us. Please send us a copy of your book when it's published.
Will do.
All right, we'll look forward to it. Aaron David Miller is a public policy scholar in the Woodrow Wilson Center here in Washington, D.C., and we hope to have him on when his book comes out. We're talking with John Mearsheimer about his book, which is about, along with Stephen Walt, he's the author of The Israel Lobby and U.S. Foreign Policy. You're listening to Talk of the Nation from NPR News. And let's see if we can get another caller on the line. And this is Mike. Mike with us from New Jersey.
Hi, Neil.
Hi.
I think both the last speakers and a number of callers have made some very good points. But for me, it's a very simple issue as far as, you know, having an ally in the region that you can count on, having an ally that's a stable ally. I think that when the one guest referred to this lobby as, you know, good old American politics, I think that I could agree with that, and I think that the American people see the need to have Israel as a solid ally in that region. It's so volatile. We're involved in what I see as a quagmire in that region at this time, and I would argue that Israel would be the least likely nation to see in Islamic fundamentalism rise. And so I think there's a natural partnership between the United States and Israel, and I do feel that it's very important to the American national security interest.
John Mearsheimer, you argue, in fact, that Israel, the United States should treat Israel as it treats any other nation.
That's exactly right, Neil. And with regard to the caller's question, the fact is that even allies sometimes behave in ways that are not consistent with the American national interest. And when those allies behave that way, the United States should distance itself from those countries, and it should use its leverage to get those countries to change their behavior. We should treat Israel as a normal country. And to go back to the issue of settlements, it has been official American policy since 1967 to oppose the settlements. We have long recognized that building settlements is bad for the United States, yet no president has been able to put any serious pressure on the Israelis to stop the settlement building. This is not good for the United States. Yes, Israel was our ally during the Cold War, but it would have been a better ally if it hadn't been building settlements. Mm-hmm. And therefore, we should have kept Israel as an ally during the Cold War, but at the same time, put serious pressure on them to stop building settlements. We're not talking here about abandoning Israel or throwing Israel to the wolves. The argument is that Israel should be treated just the way we treat Britain, just the way we treat France, and so forth and so on. And that would be better for us and for the Israelis themselves.
As opposed to the transformational policies which got us into Iraq, you call for something called offshore balancing. Is this a concept you can explain to us in about a minute and 30 seconds?
Sure, I'll do my best, Neil. During the Cold War, the United States pursued an offshore balancing policy in the Middle East. Even though we not only worried about threats that were indigenous to the region, we also worried about the Soviet Union coming into the Middle East. An offshore balancer is a country that puts most of its forces, almost all of its ground forces for sure, offshore, and does not intervene unless it's absolutely necessary to come into the region and put ground forces in there to deal with a particular problem. And indeed, if you face a problem in a region, your first choice for a strategy is to let some other local power do the heavy lifting for you. You have, in other words, an over-the-horizon capability. And this was our strategy during the Cold War. After the Cold War ended, and after the first Gulf War, the United States decided to abandon offshore balancing and physically station troops in the Middle East, in Saudi Arabia in particular. And then, after 9/11, the United States decided that it could do social engineering on a massive scale in that region with those military forces. This led to the invasion of Iraq, where we've got ourselves into untold trouble. What we should do is still care about the Middle East. It's an area of enormous strategic importance, but we should get our military assets offshore, and we should only intervene with military forces when we have no other choice and it is absolutely necessary.
You made it. Thank you.
You're welcome.
John Mearsheimer, professor of political science and co-director of the program on international security policy at the University of Chicago, co-author of The Israel Lobby and U.S. Foreign Policy. Again, you can read an excerpt at our website, npr.org/talk. Coming up, Guilt, Memories, and A Promise to the Dead, a new documentary on the life of a political exile. I'm Neil Conan. Stay with us. It's the Talk of the Nation from NPR News.